It's the News Roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. And joining us this week, Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Well, the flu hits not only the Cape, but the region hard.
Hitting it pretty hard. Our story by Heather this week was the lead says it all, really, that the Cape Cod Hospital looks more like July than January. Yeah. And that's because the ER is packed and they're seeing numbers like that you would normally see in the summertime when lots of folks are here, except most of the folks are in there, of course, with flu symptoms. And so, like you had mentioned, really, across the country, they're seeing, an increased numbers and, this increased demand for Tamiflu, which which apparently, if you take it soon enough after you get the flu, it'll shorten the time that you have the flu. So in 41 states, actually, they're reporting widespread flu-like symptoms, according to the Centers for Disease Control.
And, of course, Boston Public Health Emergency, Mayor Tomenino, because of the number of flu, we have 18 deaths so far in Massachusetts. Flu is a lot more serious than a lot of people really think it is, especially for the elderly and the young.
Right. And there was an interesting program on NPR this week that talked a lot about the flu. I thought that was really interesting. I think maybe on the Diane Rehm show.
Yeah, I think it was, yeah.
But, one thing that's interesting, even though this is a season with a lot of high numbers of people with the flu, still the numbers of people who get the flu vaccine, and in full disclosure, I guess I'm guilty of I'm one of those people that doesn't get it, even though I got the flu actually 2 years ago, first time in about 20 years. But only 35% of adults get the flu vaccine, and that number has pretty much remained steady. Maybe this year, maybe the numbers, I don't know.
Yeah, I have to admit, I'm one of those people who don't get a flu shot either, although I yesterday I almost went over to my doctor's office and got it. I'm thinking about it because, okay. I mean,
if you get the flu, though, as I did a few years ago, my first thought is, oh, man, I got to get this flu shot.
Right.
And now, of course, I think now they don't inject you with the live strain.
No, they don't, yeah.
I think for a number of people, that sort of allays some of the fears,
You can't get the flu from the flu vaccine. But the reason I did get the flu vaccine once, and it ended up being a different strain. So I was like, oh, I got this. But they say that this year's vaccine is very close, if not the same, as the strain of the flu. So it makes more sense.
I don't know enough about it, but it is fascinating to listen to how they sort of guess what strain. Not
because it mutates.
It mutates.
So it's really hard to say. But of course, along with the flu, we also have this norovirus going around. And I had it last year. It is nasty. There's a thing in the Globe today about telling the difference between the flu or the norovirus and, which do you have? Flu is an upper respiratory infection that causes sore throat, chills, body aches, runny nose, and coughing, where the norovirus is a gastrointestinal illness that causes diarrhea, vomiting, and nausea. And they say both can lead to severe dehydration if you don't drink enough fluid. So I guess that's the key. And then there's also colds. And it's like, do I have a cold? Do I have the flu?
Exactly.
And they say that one of the ways you can tell if you have a cold versus cold sort of comes on gradually, the flu just wham hits you all of a sudden. So maybe that'll help.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I'm one of the people that usually when I get sick, I try to
keep going.
I try to, exactly. I try to be in denial for as long as possible, except with the flu. The longer
you
wait, the worse it can be. And, you don't get the Tamiflu in enough time, right. And it doesn't really have the...
Yeah, when you raise your head off the pillow and go, uh-oh, I can't get up, then you're in deep doodle. But there was an interesting article that you had this week about how not to fight the flu. You cannot count on onions.
And that was so disappointing.
Wouldn't that be great?
this onion story had been going around. I saw it on Facebook initially, and then as I started to look, the story itself that I saw on Facebook sound plausible, but there were red flags.
Yeah.
There's a story about this doctor going to visit farmers and asked the wife, how did your family not get sick? And she said, oh, I cut up these onions and it absorbed the flu virus. And supposedly he found the flu in the onions. And so this story has been circulating apparently for over a century, if you cut up these onions, that they sort of work at these super germ absorbers. And so, of course, I talked to a number of people, including the National Onion Association. Did you know that they had their own association?
I did not.
There's also a potato alliance or something like that. That's a whole other story. But the Onion Association, as well as some doctors and so forth that I spoke with, said, you know, it would be nice and we would love it for it to be true just because who doesn't love onions on some level? But it turns out that they aren't this super germ absorber. And so at any rate, they're good in food. You know, they do have vitamin C. They do have health benefits. Yeah. They have some anti-inflammatory agents in them. So they smell great when you're cooking them. But
yeah, not so much to fight the flu.
Yeah. In other words, get your flu shot.
And so I guess part of this, too, is that whole placebo effect thing. You know, you believe it's like, you know, you
that's
believe
right.
Something.
You know, and I'm actually, you know, a big supporter of that. Me and a friend of mine were having a conversation about that last night. And it's kind of one of those things where if you believe it works, then, hey, maybe it works.
Maybe. Why not? It's worth a try. Exactly. Mind's a powerful thing. Well, in other news this week, Cape Cod getting possibly getting a grant to help develop a regional wastewater plan.
Right. I think they sort of have to still vote on this as a formality, but it's a $3.35 million grant from the Massachusetts Water Pollution Abatement Trust. And they're going to be giving this to the Cape Cod Commission. And, you know, it's really, you know, will help them on sort of the low end. Of course, we've talked about the current estimates of anywhere between $3 and $8 billion to really deal with the entire wastewater problem on the Cape. And this grant will basically, I think, help the Cape Cod Commission put together their regional plan. Mm-hmm. And you know, this has been a slow moving process on some fronts. But this is an important piece to get a better understanding of how best to tackle right. the problem.
Yeah. And then, of course, we also this week saw the final recommendation from the county officials released and sort of fine-tuned exactly where they think we should be going.
That's right. This is, as you mentioned, this final report on the recommendations. And I probably the not a lot of surprises in the report. One of the things that I know that Andrew Gottlieb, who is the Cape Cod Water Protection Collaborative Executive Director, wanted to, you know, make sure to emphasize, and we have a quote in here saying that unless you make it explicit, people say, hey, you didn't say it. And this is primarily in response to a lot of the criticism that's come as they've moved forward on this from some folks who are fearing that there would be some sort of regional wastewater authority, you know, with taxing powers and so forth. And so this report recommended that they do not create a structure like that. So,
so we can put that argument aside.
So yeah. We can put that argument aside. There's plenty to argue about
right.
on this front. And you know, that's one argument that many of the, you know, top folks that have been looking at this for years now want to put right. that to bed. And hopefully these official recommendations will do that.
Yeah, and we should mention, we're going to talk more about this, about the update sort of on where we are with the wastewater management plan next Thursday. We're going to have Andrew Gottlieb and Paul Nizwicki here to talk about that, so we'll get some more details on that. News roundup, we're talking with Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. County commissioners voted this week to give more power to the county administrator.
This is a one of the steps that have moved forward. Several years ago, maybe 2 years ago, the League of Women Voters of the Cape Cod area had really called for an examination of county government. You know, they felt that, well, what most of us feel is that county government is sort of in the background. You know, in other areas of the country, county government is sort of the power structure. Here in Massachusetts, we kind of do it the other way around. In fact, in most areas of the state, you know, I think in a lot of areas of the state, the county government doesn't even really exist. Here it does, but it doesn't really have a lot of, it's not really out front, doesn't have a lot of power. And so this special commission on county governance made 17 recommendations, including, you know, the establishment of what you'd call a strong county administrator. They're talking about Mark Zielinski's position over there. And they feel like by giving him, you know, more authority, you know, to basically to be the guy that has the power of the pen, to sign vendor contracts, to deal with accounts payable and payroll warrants, personnel papers, these kind of things. Now, it still requires that, you know, on anything, any contract that's $25,000 or more will need the approval of the county commissioners. Mm-hmm. So there is still some, you know, checks and balances there. But still, they'd like to give that position a little bit more teeth, which they think will strengthen and make county government run a little bit more efficiently.
Yeah, a little, and maybe more quickly.
Yeah.
Well, President Obama signed a bill this week that will preserve 140 jobs at the Otis Air National Guard Base. Doesn't it always seem like these jobs always seem to be in jeopardy from year to year, don't they?
That's right. I mean, you know, several years ago, it was the realignment commissions mm-hmm. that were looking at closing a lot of bases around the country, which they did. And at that time, they had moved the 102nd Fighter Wing to another part of the state. I forget which base they sent it to. Anyhow.
And I can't remember either.
yeah, that's embarrassing. But yeah. They moved into another part. But they did establish... They did keep the 102nd, but they turned it into this Wings Air Operations Group, and they use satellites and all this sophisticated technology to help track missions, you know, across the mm-hmm. world, really. And the legislative delegation, you know, the states, well, senators. U.S. Rep. Bill Keating have really been lobbying the Obama administration, particularly Air Force officials, because the Air Force had actually slated to shut this operation down. But so while all of us were really looking at, or at least the national media was really focused on the fiscal cliff, President Obama had signed the National Defense Reauthorization Act, or the Authorization Act, and in that it officially preserved these 140 jobs, which for, you know, legislators in our state, you know they pointed to sort of the multiplier effects in mm-hmm. terms of the impact that this would have on the regional economy if these jobs were lost.
Right. And also, there's been all this talk about making that sort of this hub for training and the security industry and all of that. And that seems like a good fit there.
Well, and the state really, you know, use military jargon, really got out ahead of this and really sort of created a preemptive task force to look at this and really just try to, you know, make the strongest case possible and have done some things, I think, to sort of ensure the vitality right. of that mission there at
Otis.
Maybe
keep us on track there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had a huge turnout for a meeting on a plan to chop off a section of Samson's Island and move it to Dead Neck. They had to move the meeting. There was so many.
They had to move the meeting, exactly. there were, typically Conservation Commission hearings don't get, you know, standing room only audiences, but this one did. The Massachusetts Audubon Society, they actually share the ownership and management of this island, which is out, you know, off of Kootenai, really, in that area. And essentially the idea is it's the Massachusetts Audubon Society, and they share the ownership and management with the Three Bays Preservation Group, which is this nonprofit organization that was established to help protect the surrounding environment. So the Massachusetts Audubon Society and the Three Bays Preservation, they want to take this 800 feet of Sampson's Island and move that material to Dead Neck, which is closer to Osterville. Mm-hmm. And they want to widen the beach there. And it's part of their long-term plan, they say, to protect or to improve the habitat for shoreboards like piping plovers. Of course, folks that use Sampson's Island say, wait a minute. There's a lot of complaints about mm-hmm. it, actually. There's some complaints from shell fishermen who are worried that this will affect, you know, this will really cut into their cost, that it will affect their, you know, the shell fishing that they do out there. You know, others actually said, wait a minute, is this some sort of, sneaky conspiracy to, you know, to protect a few homes, you know, those, you know, big homes in Osterville? The people that we've, you know, really charged with protecting the environment, the people that want to do this say, no, this is something that's needed. We need to dredge this area. The one real hiccup that could come along in this process was really raised by an attorney named Eliza Cox, who's from Nutter, McLennan, and Fish. And she represents 9 property owners out there in Kootenai. And she really had questions about whether or not the Conservation Commission even had the jurisdiction to deal with this. And she also raised questions about, well, this might call for a state environmental impact report, which, of course, would trigger a Cape Cod Commission review. And so... So as it stands now, they've pushed they've continued this hearing to sometime in March. I think March 19th.
There was also the dredging the channel there, connecting Kootenai Page and Nantucket Sound. Though folks from Three Bays are saying, if they dredge that to historic levels, it would improve navigation in the area and give greater protection from storm damage and increase water quality.
Right.
But then, of course, some of the shellfishmen are worried about, you know, dredging that, what that's going to do to the shellfish in that area. So I can kind of, you can sort of see points on both sides. And the other question I was wondering, and I know you don't know the answer to this, but is moving that, you know, 800 feet from Sampson's Island to Dead Neck, is it more, is it, you know, the erosion, is it going to stay there? It's sort of like when we do the nourishment things on the beaches. It's so temporary, it's not going to stay there. So I wonder if you're moving it and it's only going to be washed away anyway.
Right, and you're right. I don't know the answer to that
question. I don't either, but I guess that's something maybe they'll bring up at the next meeting. Who knows? It's a news roundup. We're talking with Sean Gonsalves, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Well, some Barnstable police officers are raising concerns about hypodermic needles and the need for safe disposal. We had another officer who was jabbed when he was patting down a suspect.
Right. This is the an officer. This happened last Friday. An officer with the Barnstable Street Crime Unit was, you know, frisking a suspect and who had an uncapped hypodermic needle, I guess, in their pocket or something like that. And he was punctured. He had to be taken to the hospital. And then, you know, there's sort of a protocol. You're given a series of medications and monitored. But that must be pretty scary.
Yeah, I would think so.
You know, you know, you don't know if it's a dirty needle. You don't know if it has hepatitis on it, HIV. There's all kinds of. So you can certainly understand the concern of Barnstable police officers. However, the flip side of this coin is that there's this 2006 Massachusetts law that allows people over the age of 18 to get, you know, access to, you know, the jargon, as they call them, sharps, but these hypodermic needles, clean needles. And this was really a law that was in response to real public health concerns about the spread of HIV and hepatitis C in particular among drug users. And even at that time, of course, there was a lot of controversy. Should we be giving needles to people who are doing something illegal, you know, shooting up heroin, and it's such a severe problem? But from if you look at it from a public health standpoint of view, as Yale University did, they found that these needle exchange programs actually reduced the risk of HIV transmission by a third.
Which is a lot.
Which is a lot. So it's a difficult problem because on the one hand, you obviously don't want to have police officers contracting diseases and adding to, you know, the array of occupational hazards that,
right, that
police officers
face,
have
right.
to face. You know, and unfortunately, a lot of folks who, you know, are shooting up, you know, will discard these needles. They'll throw them away, you know, and I honestly, I've seen needles and, you know, taking walks and seeing them. And it's horrifying to see, you know,
then you worry
needles.
About kids coming across.
That's right.
Them, dogs stepping
animals,
on them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, so it's, so I guess the question here is, you know, how do we find some safe disposal process?
Well, some of these aid support groups on the Cape, hand out these like disposable, you know, these canisters where you can dispose needles. They're almost like thermoses. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's something that, you know, supposedly, you know, well, that people can carry with them. It does raise the question of, you know, well, how likely are people that are going
to
be
that,
lugging these, you know, lugging those things around? And actually, I mean, if you have a drug habit of this magnitude, you're not necessarily in the mindset of, you know, of not littering.
Right, exactly.
So how effective that will be, we don't know. But it also seems like, you know, to somehow recriminalize these needles, of course, if people are... It's not going to, you know, it's not as if it's going to necessarily affect the behavior of people who have these things. And so it's a really,
it's
you know,
a
it's, a it's a difficult problem.
For
it
sure.
really is.
Well, give us the latest update on the dog ban in Drummer Boy Park. This is something we've been talking about for a while. We had the dog ban from the health department, and then we had the
lawsuit.
Lawsuit, and then we had the judge overturning it, and now we've got an appeal, but they're hoping for what, resolution?
That's right. The Board of Health, as we've talked about on this show before, banned dogs at the dog park. A dog lover who uses that park sued, won in court, and the decision was then, and the lawsuit was about whether or not the Board of Health even had the authority to do this. With the selectmen voted this week 3-2 by a 3-2 margin was to appeal the judge's ruling, and primarily they want to do this to preserve the town's right to appeal, although they hope to come to some kind of resolution outside of the court. What that resolution is going to be is unclear. There are some folks who suggest, which seems to be pretty commonsensical, at least from my perspective, which is to come up with a compromise where, you know, dogs can only be there before, I think, 7 a.m. or 10 a.m. and only after 4 p.m. In other words, giving people, especially with children, you know, the park for most of daylight hours to use the park. There's still folks who complain and say dogs should never be allowed at that park. And so there's this ongoing sort of philosophical battle about who has more rights to a public park, human beings or dogs.
And the other thing, too, is that what the argument some people are making is even if you you know, were to have the dogs just there certain hours, is the folks who don't clean up after their dogs. And I'm wondering, I don't know, but a lot of places have the little, you know, doggy bag things in case you forgot your bag, you can still clean up after your dog. And that's one of the big issues here, is because there's so many dogs there and there are a lot of people who are not cleaning up after their dogs.
Right.
And you can understand, you don't want your kids sliding.
Absolutely.
In it,
it's one of those issues, like, you know, you're talking about with bikes or whatever. There's, you know, there's always a subset of people who don't play by the rules. And of course, it makes it difficult for everyone else. Mm-hmm. And it leads to these kind of things where, you know, a handful of people essentially, you know, ruin a good time for everyone else. And then, you know, and then it leads to these kind of calls for, you know, all right, let's just get rid of it altogether.
And then, of course, there's another, maybe another compromise where part of the park could be for the dogs and part of the park could be for just people. But then again, you get the people who with their dogs off leashes who might run into that other section.
And you know, there's other towns that have created specifically
dog parks.
And so maybe that might be the solution out there in Brewster.
Right. Well, Governor's housing plan not sitting so well with Cape and Islands legislators.
Well, that's because the plan is to essentially get rid of the various housing authorities. I think there's something like 240 or something like that across the state. And the governor wants to basically regionalize. Instead of having individual towns and municipalities have their own housing authority, there would be these, I think, six regional districts who, as the governor's plan at least lays out in sort of, you know, a thumbnail sketch, it would be made up of a board that would include some governor appointees. It would include some, you know, some local officials, housing officials, as well as some tenants on these boards who would deal with, as the plan discusses, you know, administrative issues. And they're really holding it up as a way to save money. They think that this would save the state about $10 million a year, which, you know, when you're dealing with housing, you could always use some extra money,
for sure,
particularly
yeah.
in these budget times. Locally, where, you know, we checked with a lot of the state reps and state senators like Dan Wolf and Tim Madden and Cleon Turner and Sarah Peake, and all of them have basically said, you know, I don't know. You know, we've talked to a number of housing advocates anyway, locally, and they're not exactly gung-ho about this. And we're concerned about losing, you know, some local control. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I thought it was interesting that Rick Presbury, the head of HAC, said that, you know, he understands, you know, without more details, you know, the reticence that there is about consolidating. And even though a consolidation could have some real impacts on his own organization, who is the sort of the primary administrator of state funds and dealing with low income housing, he said that if there were he actually is sort of likes the idea of at least the county, you know, there being a countywide housing authority. So it's going to be interesting to see this move forward. You know, even as I was reading through the story, I get it. You know, the idea that the further away decision making comes from a local community, it can lead to some problems.
Sure.
On the other hand, when you're dealing with limited resources and you're talking about $10 million savings, it may be something worth considering.
And I guess really, as I say, the devil's in the details. There's a lot of details that we haven't heard yet. And as Rick Presbury was saying, if it's a county thing, because I think what Dan Wolf was saying, that he was concerned that this was really more you know, tailored to the urban area suburban, or rural areas. So I guess it depends on how they want to break that down. But maybe if it's, you know, this or even southeastern section of the state, that, you know, might work out. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Story to watch. Well, underwater robots are a new tool in assisting the safety of whales, especially North Atlantic right whales.
Once again, we have a very cool story out of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. This is research that's being led by Mark Bumgartner, who has been studying, I think he studies actually the behavior of predators and other species, not just whales. But in this particular instance, he actually, you know, sort of said, you know, it'd be interesting if whales were more like birds. We could monitor them. Of course, whales are underwater in one of the most mysterious places on Earth.
We can't see them.
It's difficult to see them, and they tend to stay in deep waters a lot of times and do very mysterious things. And so there's still a lot to learn about how, you know, their eating patterns and their, you know, how they congregate. And so there's one particular area where they congregate in the central Gulf of Maine, where it's usually bad weather and it's deep water. It's fairly remote. And that's an area that's been a mystery. And so with these underwater robots, they're really sort of like these torpedo-looking things where it sucks in water, which allows it to sink. And then once it gets to the bottom, it releases this water and then comes back up to the surface. And it can scan with all of these different instruments, including audio. And so And what's really cool is, so you hear the an audio of some particular whale or whale species, and it has a database, of course, and it can go through that database and identify what whale species that sound is coming from. And so water temperature, salinity, the type of communication that's going on in water, that information is transmitted to the satellite that then transmit the information back to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And it gives them some real data so that when they go out and, you know, doing human observations, and all of this really is really helpful in terms of giving them some real time and real good data on avoiding, you know, right. ship strikes,
yeah,
which is a big,
huge,
yeah.
And really, when you think about it, as expensive as technology can be, this has got to be pretty, in the long run, pretty cost effective, because the way we're doing it now is you have to have people either on the ship,
that's right,
or in an airplane, you know, trying to spot these whales over a large area. So, like when the weather's rough, you know, it's even tougher to see. So these robots can really do. You know, these guys can go home, and
it also has a potential maybe to bring a little bit more happiness, I guess, to you know, the shipping industry oftentimes mm-hmm. says, you know, these speeds that, you know, reduce speeds, you know, really aren't necessary all the time. But you know, those type of regulations are sort of based on, well, we know that generally there are whales in particular areas at this time of year. This has the potential of giving them information to say, no, there's whales there right this second, and so we can sort of adjust things as needed. And so,
and
there's also, who knows? There's probably, I'm sure there are other applications for this that go
beyond
whales.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's a pretty cool. And if you want to check it out, actually, HUI has, you know, some video and different things on their website. So it's pretty fascinating.
Well, are you smarter than a sixth grader? Kyle Thomas, the champ of the Geography Bee in Barnesville, which could land him a spot on Jeopardy and even better, a college scholarship.
That's right. Kyle, he's a sixth grader at the intermediate school. And this past Thursday, you know, all of the schools, I think, a half dozen schools across the Cape competed in this Geography Bee. And Kyle was the last man standing. I think he beat out 18 other sixth and seventh graders.
It was
a 2-hour competition. There was, you know, this long tiebreaker. It was pretty grueling, it sounds like. And so he was the last man standing, as I said, and which puts him in the running on the state level to be in the national competition. And that comes with a $25,000 scholarship, which would be nice.
That would be great. Yeah.
For, you know, for school, and also to get a chance to meet the man himself, Alex Trebek.
I know. And you had in the article, it had some of the questions that were asked. And just to give you one, since we don't have a lot of time, Kabuki is a popular form of theater that combines singing and dancing in which Asian island country?
And I'm already out of the competition.
I got that one right.
No idea.
Which country? It was Japan. Which country is not crossed by the Prime Meridian? France, Morocco, or Spain?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to go with France.
Oh, Morocco.
See?
So I have to admit, I got 3 out of 5, so I am not smart.
So I'm at like second, third grade, maybe? Okay.
Sean Collins, news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Indy Todd. Thank you for listening. Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.